This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. This month, Chattanooga Design Studio made a public call for change that included these words, quote, "We acknowledge that to address the systemic presence of racism and to confront our disgust at the racist practices existing in our society, we must start within," unquote. Eric Myers is the studio's executive director.
Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us more about the recent statement from Chattanooga Design Studio on racial injustice and equity.
Thanks for asking. We had a lot of conversations as a staff about making a statement. We knew that silence is deafening at this point in time, and we knew that we needed to do, from our conversations with our friends, particularly Black friends in our community, we knew we needed to do about four things. First of all is an acknowledgement. And second is some reflection on personal education and sharing. Third would be knowing and acknowledging that we're listening. And then the fourth is action. And so we tried to take all four of those senses, if you will, and put them into a statement.
Let's focus on the end of that. What actions are you doing? What actions are you aiming at in living up to this statement?
Well, first and foremost, we know that we can do better to listen. We know we can always do better to listen and to find and fight for Black and Brown voices in our communities that should be involved in co-creating spaces and creating change in our communities. That's first and foremost. We know that we also have a role in fostering change in the design profession that's sorely represented for Black and Brown people. We do not have the numbers of people employed in the design profession that we need, and we believe we can play a part in that. We know that we need to work even harder putting people and their places before buildings in the design of our communities. We've already started that conversation, and we know we need to work on that even harder. We know that wherever we work in our city, we need to approach the communities and residents as experts. And what I mean by that is your lived condition, your lived experience is much more valuable than my experience and my professional knowledge. And that should be put as paramount. And we know we need to continue to develop relationships that have design and co-creating spaces as design at a forefront. And lastly, we know as an organization at staff and board level, we need to educate ourselves about racial equity and injustice. And we know we need to do that and make it part of who we are and our continued learning about how we can be better people.
And in naming and addressing all of those steps, you're doing it against the backdrop of this city and its legacy in design when it comes to systemic racism. Tell me more about that legacy, what you're up against and what you're partnering with the community in this way that you're talking about is up against in terms of that legacy.
Using the term groundwater, systemic racism and the conversations that you've had with Matt Busby, for instance, were incredible in acknowledging the fact that this challenge, this crisis has been 400 years of crisis and it's everywhere. Where it manifests itself probably most presently and most boldly in urban design, and Chattanooga is not a stranger to any city actually in this across the United States, is the legacies of urban renewal. The legacy of utilizing policy, government policy of housing and transportation policy to essentially demolish entire neighborhoods and build freeways that divided those new communities, now older communities, 80 years old in some respects, dividing them from city centers and economic opportunities, essentially walling them off from any economic opportunity in cities. Those are enormous challenges. Neighborhood redlining, disinvestment due to neighborhood redlining, these are legacy challenges that now wash into and affect every bit of our work.
And we certainly saw that before the past month when we would have conversations on Scenic Roots, on WUTC, about the impact of trends such as gentrification. Gentrification didn't happen and doesn't occur in a vacuum.
That's correct. Gentrification really is happening constantly. And it happens in so many forms. And I think we have to start to recognize them and create policies that can mitigate against gentrification and displacement. We really, really need housing policies that help us understand how to address the affordability issue. And that's also nationwide. Every city in America is challenged with that right now.
One of the pitfalls in all this, and Matt Busby highlighted that in my conversation with him, is the consequences of these urban renewal policies from decades and generations ago. The intentions, at least the intentions of most of the people developing them, they were good intentions, and yet these are the consequences. What are some of the things you and your team are thinking about, other stakeholders in this community are thinking about, to make sure that even with the best of intentions, you don't wind up in some of those pitfalls as your predecessors in prior generations found themselves with what we're living with now?
Excellent question. And some of it's embedded in the action statements that I mentioned earlier. People before buildings. People before buildings. That's a completely different way of looking at planning. I think up until now, we, and my career has been in that way, shaping spaces by thinking of buildings. We have to put people first, and we have to listen to where people are and the challenges that they have. And some of the work that we've been doing has been incredibly rewarding in that respect. We are working on a pilot project at Patton Towers, the little square there at 11th and Market Street. It's the highest residential density population in our downtown. And now more than ever, that vulnerable population needs an outdoor space to enjoy, to linger, and to share with one another. And we engage Genesis Great Kids to help us understand some of the underlying challenges so that we could have meaningful conversations with the residents of Patton Towers to understand where they are with that space and understand how that space could really, really help the experience of an outdoor life, a public life. So it's measurements like that that we know that will really have no effect on displacement. It actually should make placemaking and placekeeping, because people will want to stay in that space.
And that's a word that I think we're going to be hearing more of, which is placekeeping.
Yes, that term comes to the forefront quite a bit. And I mentioned on your show a while ago, one of my heroes, Maurice Cox, is a planner in the Northeast. He's in Chicago now, I believe, and his comment about planning for those that stayed, that has resonance. And I constantly try to slow myself, understand where my biases are, and definitely connect to the people that stayed.
Speaking about yourself, you've talked about the work that the studio is doing. What personal work have you embarked on in all this?
Quite a bit. I mentioned to everyone that I'm close to that the last year of my life was an incredible inflection. Began with some things I'm very fortunate to have been involved with. The first, I did a series of racial equity and injustice training classes locally with a group of about 25 Chattanoogans. Doing that work together, understanding, educating myself about this history that really is not shared in common education practice. It's not shared. It's buried, unfortunately. Educating myself about that and then finding out where I am in this entire process has been good. I also took some time with a group of about 20 to 30 Chattanoogans and visited the site in Montgomery where the Legacy Museum and Memorial were created for racial equity and justice by the Equal Justice Initiative, Brian Stevens's group. And again, very moving, very informative about this history and about its legacy, and also inflecting on my personal experience. And doing that with friends in Chattanooga in a facilitated manner was incredibly informative. And then locally doing anti-racism and cultural competency training. So I've been doing quite a bit of this and looking at myself really introspectively. And Ray, I'll also tell you that I've been trying to find ways that, you know, I have two boys, 8 and 13, and I'm ashamed to say this, I really am, but we finally had that talk as a family that every Black family has had probably every Sunday throughout their entire life for decades now. We finally had that talk, and I'm ashamed that it's taken that long to have this talk, but we needed to do it. And I want to share with you what my 8-year-old said. He said, "Dad, I think it's completely unfair that we have parts of our community where people are treated differently because they have pigment in their skin because their ancestors grew up close to the equator. And I said, yeah, you know, that is unfair. That's really unfair. And he said, it's kind of false, isn't it? I said, absolutely, it's false.
And thank you for sharing that. And where can people go online to follow what the Chattanooga Design Studio is doing on all this?
We have a social media presence. We're on Instagram, chattanoogastudio.com. We also have a website. We update our website frequently with our current projects and programs, and hope that you follow us there and hope that you visit our website and see what we're up to. And by all means, call us, schedule an appointment. We can meet you in the park and would love to chat with anybody about this work.
All right. Eric, thanks so much.
Thanks, Ray.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
I'm Will Davis, and this is Tennessee Valley StoryCorps. Conversations from StoryCorps' mobile recording booth when it came to Chattanooga's Miller Park last year. Today, Jim Ledbetter talks to his wife, Katie LaRue, about building a cabin in northern Canada and returning to the cabin for the first time with Katie 45 years later.
I grew up in Chattanooga. My dad was an independent businessman, ran a dry cleaning business. He started right after World War II. And I wanted to do something totally different. Mostly, I wanted to go to the woods. I wanted to be away from people. I did not want to be dependent on making a living and making money and dealing with all the hassles that that part of the life would involve. So back in 1970, I went to British Columbia and lived in the backwoods for several years.
Let's go ahead, if you don't mind, and move into how you came about to build the cabin.
Ah, okay, okay. I can
now, don't get too technical.
Well, that's the thing.
Not
about,
everybody out there wants to know how to build a cabin step by step.
Well, that's the thing about log cabins. They really aren't that technical. It's just a lot of work. It was about a little over 20 foot long and about 12 or 15 foot wide. So
in October of 2018, you took me there.
Yeah.
And
there it was.
And there it was. It looked
exactly
perfect.
Like I had left it.
Amazing.
One thing that has kept the cabin open for other people to use, that have kept wood in the box and food in the pantry and it being open to the public, is a note that I placed on the door in a picture frame on the outside of the door going into it. And it has touched everybody's heart that comes up there, I do believe.
I think so. Go ahead and read it, Jim.
Well, I took a picture of it while we were up there in the fall, and surprisingly, it hadn't faded and it all looks the same. But it goes, "Welcome, stranger, to my cabin, if this way you chance to pass. On the door there is no padlock. There is no need to break the glass. You will find some kindling whittled neatly in the box. Build yourself a fire. As for wood, there is lots. Chances are that you are hungry. In the food cans have a look. Mine are simple eats but plenty. All you have to do is cook. Use the bed if you are sleepy. May your dreams all happy end. Here's to better luck tomorrow, my unknown friend."
Still there after all these.
Still there. The door has never been locked since I built the cabin.
That was Jim Ledbetter and Katie LaRue. This Tennessee Valley StoryCorps conversation and others can be found on our website, wutc.org, and you can subscribe to the Tennessee Valley StoryCorps podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. This series is produced and edited by me and brought to you in part by EPB Fiber Optics. I'm Will Davis.
This is Scenic Roots. Good afternoon. I'm Richard Winham. We have a session again for you from Barking Legs, part of their Wednesday Night Jazz series, which has been on hiatus for about the last 3 weeks. They are working to bring it back again. Of course, they would love to have it live in the lounge, but at the moment, that's still somewhere in the future. For the moment, they're just trying to get it back to a streaming series on Wednesday evenings. So for this evening, given that it's on hiatus, this is a show from earlier this month. We played some of this show for you a couple of weeks back. It's the Alan Wyatt Trio. Alan Wyatt is a sax player, the redoubtable Sean Perkinson playing guitar, and the equally redoubtable David Schwab playing bass. A virtual live in the lounge show from Signal Mountain, filmed by my friend Dan Landrum, and thanks to Dan for this. And if you'd like to see the video, it is still up on the Barking Legs Facebook page. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's dig around midnight. Yeah, he'll have to dial that up. So some people, of course, Around Midnight is a Thelonious Monk composition, and there's a very famous Miles Davis introduction that we're not going to do. So those of you Miles Davis fans out there that really need that, you'll just need to go to, you know, go find your recording of it, because this might not be so gratifying for you. So as soon as Sean remembers where R is in the alphabet, that was a joke. Okay. So no intro. We'll just.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
This is a Wes Montgomery contrafact. That's the buzzword of the day. Contrafact is a new melody written over a standard chord progression. And Wes Montgomery called this 4-on-6, and it's written to the progression of Summertime, which absolutely it is in this room as well. So, in fact, I think it was said 95 degrees. I think that's what.
What?
Yeah, somewhere in my car. Maybe that was just inside my car, but anyway.
Turn the heat down.
So, yeah. So, hopefully you will enjoy Wes Montgomery's version of Summertime, which he called 4-on-6.
Thank you.
The Alan Wyatt Trio recorded for a virtual Jazz in the Lounge at Barking Legs on Scenic Roots here on WUTC.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Thanks, as always, to our producers, Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, Elena Nourabadi, Connor Brown, and Will Davis. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.